Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money, major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 0.035% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching never changed anything.
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Aside from the obvious destruction and violence, the most frustrating thing about the last week of riots is the incoherence, the lack of explanation for what exactly the grievance is and what exactly we can all do about it to address the issue constructively. As far as the George Floyd case that is the purported reason for this chaos, it's difficult to argue that America is some broadly racist country complicit in and approving of his death when, one, there's still no evidence that his death had anything to do with racial bias, at least not yet, and two, there is nobody arguing that what happened to George Floyd was justified or proper. I've heard literally zero people make that case. And it's similarly difficult to argue this case demonstrates that we turn a blind eye to police brutality. The officer responsible is sitting in jail charged with murder. And Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, an ally of Antifa, whose Minneapolis City Councilman's son also pledged allegiance to Antifa over the weekend, says he expects to bring charges against the three other officers standing by throughout the incident. There was no cover-up. There was no abdication of justice. The case isn't just being prosecuted, it's being prosecuted by the leftmost flank of the left. What more do you want, short of everyone getting a swing at Derek Chauvin's strung-up pinata body until there's nothing left? When the grievance is unclear, so too is the solution. When we can't explain why we're destroying the country, we can't explain what it will take to stop destroying the country, and the destruction just becomes the status quo, done for its own sake. And this incoherence, this Inability or refusal to diagnose the problem and prescribe a solution in specific terms was perfectly demonstrated by one of the most unlikely meetings of media personalities I've seen in some time. I was driving around doing errands on Monday, and Rush Limbaugh was on the radio, and he mentioned he had just finished taping a segment with The Breakfast Club, featuring among his two other co-hosts, Charlamagne the God, fresh off being told by Joe Biden that he's not black unless he votes Democrat.
If you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
For his part, Rush at least had the courtesy to ask The Breakfast Club why they vote the way they do, and not tell them to vote the way he commands.
Why do you still vote Democrat?
I vote for whoever I think is the best candidate.
Because the Democrat Party has been promising to fix your grievances for 50 years, and you have the same grievances, you have the same complaints. They haven't done a damn thing.
I don't disagree with you, and that's why I'm not letting nobody politicize black pain and tell us that this is one person's fault just because they are trying to win an election in November. This is America's fault.
All of America's fault is a statement so broad, there's no specific solution to be provided. If America as a whole is the problem, then the deconstruction of America is the only plausible response, hence the situation that we're in. But before we get to that main theme of being a perpetual victim against the all-encompassing, unfalsifiable shadow monster of white privilege, there are a few positive things I can say about this interview. First, the fact that it happened at all. It's a bummer that simply being willing to speak with an opposing voice is an effort worthy of praise, but it's certainly good relative to the alternative of lighting the guy's business on fire, and rightly or wrongly, that is the current benchmark. And second, Rush's approach to the conversation. I expected him to come in swinging, with half his brain tied behind his back just to make it fair, as he likes to say. I expected combative challenge to the Breakfast Club's points. But he didn't do that. Instead, he sought common ground. He sought understanding. He started the conversation by condemning the death of George Floyd.
And I don't want to forget about George Floyd. What happened to George Floyd sickened me, and I wanted to reach out and tell you all this. I want to make sure you have no doubt, and I'm not the only American who feels this way.
And the rest of Rush's points in questioning were directed at understanding the Breakfast Club's perspective, not destroying it. And the reason I appreciated that approach is not just because it's kind, but because it was effective, argumentatively and persuasively. Rush didn't have to destroy the Breakfast Club. Their own inability to explain and defend their positions did that for him. It was first apparent on a few claims of fact. The Breakfast Club repeatedly claimed that George Floyd is not an isolated incident, that his case is part of a pattern of police targeting black people because of racism.
This is a country, America, that denies, you know, black people justice and just plain decency, and then they act like we're just supposed to be happy to be here. R.I.P. to George Floyd, but that was not an isolated incident. This is a regular occurrence
for
black people in this country.
George Floyd wasn't doing anything wrong. Breonna Taylor got killed in her house. She wasn't doing anything wrong. And so it's not that people haven't adapted to things. It's just that we get targeted and then there's no punishment when the police officers commit these crimes against us.
Well, first of all, there is punishment for police crimes. Specifically the cases you reference. Derek Chauvin is in jail right now. And the cops in the Breonna Taylor case are under investigation and charges remain possible. As to the claim that black people are targeted for lethal force from police more frequently because of racism, that is not conclusively true. It is true that black people are killed by police at a disproportionate rate, but it's an unsubstantiated leap to attribute that gap strictly to racism. There are other variables that are relevant and highly likely to explain, such as, importantly, violent crime rates. If you are committing more violent crime, you are also facing more contentious police encounters, and thus the likelihood for lethal force increases. And that is exactly what recent studies find. When you control for violent crime rates, police are not necessarily more likely to shoot minority suspects over white suspects. A 2019 study by Michigan State University researchers concludes, quote, "We find no evidence of anti-black or anti-Hispanic disparities across shootings, and white officers are not more likely to shoot minority civilians than non-white officers. The race of the person shot is strongly predicted by race-specific crime rates." Similarly, a 2016 study from a Harvard researcher finds that controlling for crime rates as well as civilian behavior upon police confrontation explains a significant portion of racial disparities in police use of lethal force, ultimately concluding that when appropriate variables are controlled for, quote, we find no racial differences in police use of lethal force. Now, are these studies gospel? No, they are data-driven analyses with faults. Faults that have been scrutinized and criticized, they're not perfect, but they do give us reason to suppose that disproportionate use of lethal force from police can't automatically be attributed to police racism. There are other factors that are demonstrably relevant, factors that bring lethal force against white people just as much as they bring lethal force against black people. And speaking of similar lethal force against white people, another factor to consider is media selection bias, which cases make the news and which cases don't. A consideration relevant when Charlemagne says what happened to George Floyd would never happen to a white man.
White privilege is that what happened to George Floyd would not have happened to a white man.
If what happened to George Floyd had happened to a white man, we probably wouldn't even have heard about it.
You definitely would have heard about it. You definitely would have been. You definitely would have heard about it.
You
wouldn't hear about it. And you know why? Because that cop would have been arrested. He would have been fired. He would have been charged with murder a long time before all of this.
Yeah. Well, we don't actually have to speculate about such cases, hypothetically. There are such cases. To Rush's point, have you ever heard the name Tony Timpa? He was a white man arrested and killed by police in Dallas in 2016. In a way strikingly similar to George Floyd, police pinned him by the shoulders, knees, and neck to the ground. He pleaded with officers, screaming, "You're going to kill me," and begging for mercy.
Help me!
Get on the ground.
No, you're going to kill me. Please let me go, please.
And much like Floyd, there wasn't resistance from Tony Timpa. In fact, the police department reported no resistance in the state death report. Also, much like Floyd, he was dead when an ambulance arrived. But in a detail even beyond Floyd, the cops were making fun of Tony while he died.
He asleep?
Yeah, he's asleep.
No worries, that's what it was.
Yeah, he's asleep.
I don't want to go to school.
First day, you can't be late.
We bought you new shoes. It's the first day of school, come on.
Made breakfast, scrambled eggs, favorite.
Went waffles.
Waffles.
Now, like me, you probably never heard that story. And Rush argues that's because media have no appetite to report stories about police brutality against white people. The Breakfast Club argues you didn't hear that story because those cops would be immediately charged and jailed. Except they weren't. Charges against the cops were dropped, and their mockery of Tony Timpa was characterized as just a, quote, strategy to wake him up. The trouble is, though, any and all counter evidence is worthless in the Breakfast Club's argument. White privilege and white supremacy are the unfalsifiable overlords under which we all live, and any argument otherwise is to be dismissed and mocked on its face. Rush tries to understand their case in good faith, asking them to define their terms. What is white privilege? What is white supremacy? We would like to know so we can stop it.
You keep harping on white privilege and racism. Would you tell me how to end it? What can we do to end this so that you are not frustrated and angry and feeling like whatever you feel like?
And you'll notice two things about their answers. First, they are so general and vague, there is no plausible response or action. It's just empty buzzwords. We have to dismantle systems and mechanisms that marginalize. That's just slightly advanced Joe Biden talk. You know, the thing.
You had people electing the first African-American president in our history.
That's
he
right.
served for 8 years. Why isn't there anything to show for it that makes you less angry than you were then?
Doesn't matter who's in the White House if that person is not willing to dismantle the mechanism of white
Come
supremacy.
Come on, guys. Elections don't matter now?
We got to stop acting like white supremacy isn't done by design. The whole function of systemic racism is to marginalize black people. And it's very hard to get any damn near 80-year-old white man to change a system that's been working for him and his family for years. We need people that are willing to dismantle the mechanism of white supremacy.
And second, you'll notice the Breakfast Club actually flips the obligation onto Rush. Rush wants to understand what they view as the problem and what they view as the solution. And throughout the interview, they say it's Rush's job to describe the solution for them.
How do we dismantle white supremacy as a whole moving forward?
You'd have to define what it means to you.
They say they can't even solve their problems until white people do it for them.
I do think it is important for white people to acknowledge the hurt that they've inflicted on the African American community and to be able to come forward and admit that we can't even move forward until that happens.
And even though Rush has made a good faith effort to understand them, Charlemagne still rejects his invitation to continue the conversation.
We're out of time here, but would you guys like to do this again where we pick it up right from this point and make a focus on white supremacy?
Not if we just going to dance the whole time. If you're going to have some honest conversation with us and stop telling us things like white privilege,
Charlemagne,
and you don't know what white supremacy is, if we could do that, yes.
You say the problem can't be solved until white people understand. So this white person shows up and tries to understand, and you mock him for not understanding. Do you see how this is unsolvable? And it's not just that that's poor argument form, it's that it's poor life form. It stifles your potential. That is a philosophy and a worldview that says everything I don't like is somebody else's fault, and I'm powerless to do anything about it until somebody else does it for me. That is a view that ensures you remain powerless in exactly the way you complain about. That is a view that ensures that your dreams never get realized, because that is a view that ensures that you never try. And if you never try, I'd ask you to explain how you ever expect to succeed. But since asking for explanation is apparently yet another mechanism of white privilege and white supremacy to be dismantled, I'm left only to explain it myself. You won't. Thanks, as always, for listening and for supporting this channel. Always appreciate that thoughtful discussion down below, and especially over on Twitter. That is at ML Christensen. You're always welcome to coming out and chat in my live streams. Those are linked down in the description. Looking forward to it. Goodbye.
And today's live stream is titled Hip Hop Industries Plus Jeff Bezos Equal Billions of USD, United States Dollars, 619-768-2945. It's a holiday week, and for those here in the United States, of course, we have people that listen to this live stream around the globe. But today's what we call over here a bank holiday. Government offices and banks are closed. So we're sort of like doing trending topics on this. I put Jeff Bezos into today's headline because last week, and I ended up defending Jeff Bezos on like three different occasions. Anyway, so we're going to discuss him, the hip hop industries, and I played the Breakfast Club segment because. Breakfast Club they cater to a large demographic, hip-hoppers, which is a diversified demographic. They've got a lot of political power. They have a lot of economic power. And you've got not only people like Rush Limbaugh, or the late Rush Limbaugh who's been on there, but Hillary Clinton, one of the former presidents of the country of Mexico, Malcolm Gladwell. So they've had President Joe Biden was on there, Vice President Kamala Harris was on there. A lot of different people that you wouldn't expect to be on a hip-hop talk show show up for the Breakfast Club. All right. And hip-hop is actually... I said billions, but there's probably trillions of dollars within the hip-hop demographic. So I'm going to play this. 619-768-2945 if you guys have got any comments on that or anything else trending or anything you want to talk about. We weren't on last week. It's amazing how that storm that hit, well, it hit several places, but storm that hit New Orleans affected somebody in Florida, mainly me. So we're going to, you know, how you can place yourself or get yourself in a position. You know, actually, it's not restricted to hip-hop, because hip-hop isn't a lot of stuff fundamentally economic about hip-hop. is not new. It's, you know, it's just a particular generation is new to them. So we're going to bring that up on how to fortify yourself economically. So no matter what act of nature happens, for the most part, you'll be all right. Anyway, we're going to play another clip from the Rush Limbaugh, when he Rush Limbaugh visited the Breakfast Club. And if you got any comments, 619-768-2945. Then we're going to merge that into hip-hop billionaires. Hip-hop billionaires, and then what you can do economically. You might not want to be a billionaire or a millionaire, but there's some things, I think, basic that they do. You don't have to do it to the degree that they do it, but, you know, it might take a note.
Wake that ass up early in the morning.
The Breakfast Club.
What up, everybody? It's DJ Envy, Angela Yee, Charlamagne Tha God. We are The Breakfast Club. Now, we are fed up. We're angry, hurt, and tired. The country is wounded. The phrase, I can't breathe, is embedded in our minds forever. The inhumane treatment and senseless murder of George Floyd has to be the final straw. This was not the first time, but this has to be where it stops. For almost 10 years, we have been the voice of our community, working to push our culture forward, focusing on educating our listeners on entrepreneurship, real estate, mental health, education, and the importance of being politically engaged and informed. We have always had diverse guests and are open to the tough conversations. In that spirit, today we are having a candid conversation with fellow broadcaster Rush Limbaugh. Why are we having this conversation with someone whose historical viewpoints differ so significantly from ours and who we represent? Because the dialogue has to be open beyond who we know or who we talk to every morning. Today, Rush's listeners will hear us, probably for the first time ever. What we are witnessing in our nation right now is not normal, and it compels our attention to understand every side and look for ways to bring this country together and stop the senseless killing of our people. So we will start with a conversation that we think might be the first step. Ladies and gentlemen, Rush Limbaugh.
Every Democrat candidate for president this year has made it their business to appear on The Breakfast Club. And now it's my honor to appear on The Breakfast Club, excuse me, even though I'm not a Democrat. Now, guys, can I tell you why I wanted to? The George Floyd story is being lost.
Right.
There are two things happening in America, and it sickens me what happened to him. Legitimate national outrage about a policeman's criminal brutality has been hijacked. And I don't want to forget about George Floyd. What happened to George Floyd sickened me, and I wanted to reach out and tell you all this. I want to make sure you have no doubt, and I'm not the only American who feels this way, the senselessness of it. You know, we're only given one life. We don't get a do-over. We only get one. We all take it for granted because it just happened. We're born. We don't even remember that. But George Floyd had his taken away from him. He didn't lose it. He had it taken away from him in a senseless, stupid way. And I think most Americans are just as angry and sad about this as I am. And I'm also angry at the cops that stood around there and didn't do anything to stop it. It was just, I can't tell you how frustrated it is. And I just wanted to share the emotion I have with you guys about this, and to try to convey to you that I actually think most Americans are just as sickened and outraged by it as I am.
Yeah, and you know what? One of the worst things is that I feel like we're so accustomed to being in these situations where we get frustrated, where nothing happens, and these police officers are back out doing the same thing over and over again. And that's part of the frustration, is this is not an isolated incident. This is something that's been happening in our community. It hasn't stopped. We don't see when it will stop. And I think people are frustrated, and it's a combination of so many different things right now.
Well, that's, I think, absolutely right. If you look at the actual circumstance here, you had what happened to him. It's on video. You've got the cop standing there almost looking like he's bragging or having fun, exerting power. How stupid is the cop? Can the cop not be aware of what we in this country are going through precisely because of what he's doing at that moment? How can anybody be that insensitive or stupid. It's beyond me to understand.
It almost felt like that the more that people were telling him that he was killing him and that it was blood coming out of his nose and that he was lifeless, he really felt like, just looking at his face, I think that was probably the closest thing to a devil that I've ever seen in my life. It was his ego that just allowed him to keep applying pressure and taking that man's life.
I can't.
Let me ask you a question, Russ. This is
sure.
Charlamagne talking. We've seen numerous police killings of unarmed black people in this country. Why is the George Floyd situation the one that's making you say enough is enough and this needs to stop? Why this situation in particular?
Because I'm fed up with it. I'm not tolerant of any of them. But I'm fed up with it, Charlamagne. None of this. See, to me, and I know that you're going to disagree with me on this.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is not America. It's a sad.
Oh no, it's definitely America.
Well, see, but it's not what we can be. It's not what we have been. We're the greatest nation in history of the world, and we haven't achieved that on the basis
for who though, Russ? I think it's easy for you to say because you're a white male, and that comes with a different level of privilege. And I do think America does work, but it works for the people that it was designed to work for. It doesn't work for everybody else the way it works for you.
Well, it can. That's the point of America. It can for anybody who wants to adapt to it, for anybody who wants to try to take advantage of the unique opportunities that exist in the United States. We're the only nation that's ever enshrined the concept of individual liberty and freedom in our founding documents. We're the only country that's ever created a document to govern ourselves by that limits government. Now,
George Floyd wasn't doing anything wrong. Breonna Taylor got killed in her house. She wasn't doing anything wrong. And so it's not that people haven't adapted to things. It's just that we get targeted, and then there's no punishment when the police officers commit these crimes against us.
No.
And then when we talk about it.
I didn't mean to conflate that George Floyd could have stopped what was going to happen to him. Don't misunderstand.
Okay. There,
George Floyd is the essence of innocence. But what I'm saying is that America is a place with robust opportunity if you want to go out and look for it and find it. Now, the people ripping up the streets today and last night, the Antifa types, they don't care to find the opportunity. They disagree with the whole construct of America.
Well, no, I got to push back on you with that, too. It's not just the Antifa types. You know what I'm saying? Like you see all these white folks out there protesting, looting, raising hell. You know what I'm saying? Let's not act like there isn't 40 million people who have filed for unemployment in America. Folks been sitting around the last 3 months waiting on stimulus checks. More than 44% of those people have been denied unemployment checks are still waiting on them to come. People of all races are broke. They don't know where their next meal is coming from. Their savings are exhausted. If they had any, they don't know how they're going to pay bills. So, of course, they're going
right.
to go out there and loot. Of course, they're angry and frustrated.
Unnecessarily, it turns out. Unnecessarily. There's no reason to shut down the country. There was no reason to lock everybody. Of course, you put 40 million people out of work and tell them, you know, you penalize them when they do try to open their businesses. You're going to create a powder keg. A powder keg has been created. But
That's why I can't allow you to say that it's just Antifa out there, because it is a lot of white people who are fed
up.
Well,
but the Antifa people look. The Antifa people are the violent ones. The Antifa people are the ones that are trying to capitalize on it. There's some legitimate, heartfelt people out there peacefully protesting. But look, you guys, let me tell you, you are a testament to the opportunity available in America. Look at you. How did you do it? What did you have to overcome to become the Breakfast Club? And what did you have to overcome to become dominant in morning drive and American radio? Who held you back, or what were you able to overcome in order to do it? The opportunity is there. It's the only thing I'm saying.
Right, but you know, you talk about peacefully protest, right? And you were very opinionated about Colin Kaepernick, and he was peacefully protesting, right? And now people are saying, no, they're not peacefully protesting. This is the same thing Colin Kaepernick was kneeling for that the world was so upset about. And the world said he's taking it too far, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. This is exactly the reason why he was kneeling and protesting. The fact that an unarmed African-American man was doing nothing. They still don't even know if he had a fake $10 or $20 bill or not. And that man kneeled on George Floyd for damn near 9 minutes and killed that man, murdered that man.
Look,
and looked at us like, yeah, I'm doing it, and what?
You guys, I'm trying to tell you, I'm all with you. I'm 1,000% with you on this. This is why I wanted to talk to you, because I know that there are, you know, we all have preconceptions that we live under and biases that we live under, and I wanted to reach out to you guys specifically. You were the ones that I was told to speak to, that mm-hmm. this is intolerable.
I'm happy to have the conversation. I'm glad you're having it, because I think your audience needs to hear it. And, you know, you said something a little while ago, and I want to just, you know, talk about that. You know, this is a country, America, that denies, you know, black people justice and just plain decency, and then they act like we're just supposed to be happy to be here because it allows a few of us to make
when
a few
did
dollars
I say
while
that?
The majority of us out here catch hell. Well, you said, you know,
you guys made it.
Y'all are mm-hmm. successful. You know what I'm saying? Like, but the rest of us are catching hell out here. R.I.P. George Floyd,
but
we can't act
second.
Like this is an isolated incident.
Charlemagne, you're adding things to my mouth that I didn't say. You're adding syllables I have not uttered. I was trying to be complimentary of you, and I'm trying to illustrate that you are an example to others that want to try. You can succeed. Let me ask a quick question. If the Minnesota Vikings had announced 2 nights ago mm-hmm. that they were going to hire Colin Kaepernick, would the riots have stopped?
No. Nobody gives a shit about that. What are we talking about?
Well,
Colin
you guys,
Kaepernick,
what do you mean? You guys brought up Kaepernick.
Kaepernick. His name is Kaepernick. And
Kaepernick,
the reason I brought him up is because he was so opinionated about
Colin,
him protesting.
And I'm just asking, if the Vikings had signed him, would the people of Minnesota, oh, good, okay, he's got a gig.
You know,
we're not going to protest anymore.
Because that's not going to stop white supremacy. That's not going to stop racism, okay? We got to – R.I.P. to George Floyd, but that was not an isolated incident. This is a regular occurrence
for
black people in this country.
How do you
stop
it?
The powers that be don't want to change the system.
How do you stop –
that's a question for you.
I
want to know,
guys,
how are you going to use your privilege as a white male to combat this prejudice? You got a direct line.
I don't buy into the notion of white privilege. See, I think that's liberal political construct right along the lines of political correctness. It's designed to intimidate and get people to shut up and admit they're guilty of doing things they haven't done.
You know what white privilege is? White privilege is that what happened to George Floyd would not have happened to a white man. White privilege right there.
If what happened to George Floyd had happened to a white man, we probably wouldn't even have heard about it.
Huh?
You definitely would have heard about it. You definitely would have been. You definitely would have heard about it. You definitely
would have.
If George Floyd, there's
a lot of instances where this does happen and we don't hear about it. There's a lot of times that there's no video that exists, and then people are police officers lie and they say this is what happened, just like we've seen it happen so many different times where fortunately there was video. There's a lot of cases that won't make it.
That never make it to TV, that never make it to social media because there is no phones.
What I said, guys,
video?
I said if George Floyd were white, we wouldn't have heard of this. And if the same thing had happened to him, we wouldn't have heard about it. There wouldn't be, you know,
You'd be outraged, right? You're right, Charlemagne.
You wouldn't hear about it. And you know why? Because that cop would have been arrested. He would have been fired. He would have been charged with murder a long time before all of this.
Yeah.
Immediately, before the video hit the social media, he would have been charged, fired, arrested, locked up and all that if George Floyd was white.
There's a Muslim officer in Minneapolis now doing 12 and a half years because he accidentally killed a white woman. And on duty. So I mean, I don't get it. But let me ask you a question, Wes. Because I remember in 2014, you criticized President Obama, and you said he should do more to ease racial tensions in the wake of the grand jury decisions to not indict the white police officers in Ferguson. You said if he wants to, he can inspire, and I think is called for in this situation. Shouldn't that same advice apply to President Trump right now?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it applies to all presidents. Absolutely. No question about it. That's one of their roles, is to calm circumstances and situations like this. But look, guys, can I ask you keep harping on white privilege and racism. Would you tell me how to end it? What can we do to end this so that you are not frustrated and angry and feeling like whatever you feel like. Because I hate it. I hate you guys.
People.
We're
That's
all
one.
Americans here, and I don't like
officers.
The fact
That's
that you're
two.
Angry all
well,
the time. So what can we do to stop the racism?
Here's the thing, right? As long as there's a system of white supremacy, you know, there will always be these type of situations. You know, it doesn't matter who's in the White House. If that person is not willing to dismantle the mechanism of white supremacy, if that person is not willing to change legislation that disproportionately impacts black folks, it doesn't matter. You know what I'm saying? Like, we've seen this a million times.
Okay,
the
LA tell
riots,
me
the
what
Ferguson
happened.
Riots.
You had 4 years of Barack Obama. You had Americans, white Americans, voting for Obama because they wanted to say we're not racist. We're not a racist country. You had people electing the first African American president in our history.
That's
he
right.
served for 8 years. Why isn't there anything to show for it that makes you less angry than you were then?
Once again, it doesn't matter who's in the White House if that person is not willing to dismantle the mechanism of white
supremacy.
Come
on, guys. Elections
matter
don't matter now?
I think that when we got to stop acting like white supremacy isn't done by design. The whole function of systemic racism is to marginalize black people. And it's very hard to get any damn near 80-year-old white man to change a system that's been working for him and his family for years. I don't care if it's Biden or Trump. So once again, we need people that are willing to dismantle the mechanism of white supremacy.
Okay,
period.
Let me ask you guys, why do you still vote Democrat?
I vote for whoever I think is the best candidate.
Because the Democrat Party has been promising to fix your grievances for 50 years, and you have the same mm-hmm. grievances, you have the same complaints. They haven't done a damn thing for you. They haven't even punished the people that you think are responsible for the racism and bigotry being done to you. Why do you keep supporting them?
And you know, I don't disagree with you, and that's why I'm not letting nobody politicize black pain and tell us that this is one person's fault just because they are trying to win an election in November. This is America's fault. And the war on drugs, mass incarceration, segregation, slavery, all of those things are and have been the proverbial knee on the back of black folks' neck. And until somebody is willing to dismantle the mechanism of white supremacy, nothing is going to change.
Well, Rush, I also don't want to lose track of what we're talking about here because I know we're trying to focus on George Floyd and what's happening with him and how can we take some actionable steps to move forward and what can be done, right? So on your end, what are some things that you feel like can be done?
I think that cop should be charged with first-degree murder, and
absolutely.
I think that the guys standing around ought to be charged, the other cops that were standing around. I think it's time to end this. We are all aware of police brutality. We're all aware of the actions that some rogue cops take, and it's way too many of them against African American men. And it's time to stop. And I'm not a policeman. I'm not an executive in a police department. But it seems to me that if those people end up being charged instead of shielded when they commit murder, there shouldn't be any legalized murder, and that would be one way. To at least get a start on making sure it doesn't happen. This George Floyd was, for everything I've been able to tell, was a good guy. He was a nice guy, had a family. He said, did not even come close to deserving having his life taken from him like that.
Not at all. Not at all. Now, do you agree with the way that the media is portraying everything? You're in media, and you know media is white media, of course. Do you agree with how they're portraying everything that's going on right now?
God, I don't think we've gotten the truth out of most media in 3 or 4 years. I don't know. I think that's another reason why people are mad, you guys. They know they've been lied to. They were lied about so many things for 2, 3, 4 years now. And so now they don't know what to believe coming out of the media. And I don't care what it is, Fox, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post. There doesn't seem to be anywhere in our culture that people have trust in an institution or series of institutions that provide a backstop and reliability when something like this happens. And I think that's creating or contributing to even more of the unrest that's happening out there.
Rush, how would you advise Donald Trump to handle this situation? Because I see that he's having some issues. He's calling people thugs. He's talking about sticking the dogs on people if they try to come into the White House. But then you see how he treats people who are protesting the stay-at-home order, and they have guns, and they're white people, and they're fine people. So I just want to know, what advice would you give to the president right now to say, this is what we need to do, and this is how you should handle it? Because I don't think that he's handling it properly with his verbiage.
I think what the president ought to do is use the God-given humility that he has, and don't doubt me that he does. He has a lot of humility.
There's nothing humble about the president. Come
well,
on.
No, there is. Even if at every rally, you will see his appreciation for the people that show up. But it's simple matter of understanding he's president of everybody here, and trying to quell these moments of unrest is something that would be really, really to his advantage.
I think what you said about Obama in 2014 applies. When you said if he wants to, he can inspire. And I think it's called for in this situation.
But I don't think he wants
to inspire. I think he wants to incite.
I do agree with you about the inspiration. I think he can. I think he should. I think all presidents should. In terms of Trump inciting, look, the guy has had everybody and their uncle telling lies and falsehoods about him for 3.5-4 years now. And he's probably a little fed up with it. Yeah, before the shutdown happened, look at what black unemployment was. It was a record low. The number of African Americans have had jobs. The wages were going up. And then this virus comes along and the bottom is pulled out from it. He's got to be frustrated as he can be. And I'm not trying to carry his water.
Well, the black unemployment rate started going down under Obama, too, though. I mean, that's one thing that Trump takes credit for that actually started under President Obama.
It did? Okay. Well, that's...
Yes.
Then
can I ask you a question, Russ?
Yeah.
Moving forward, all right, because, you know, let's say the cops get arrested, the cop gets charged, he goes to jail, great. How do we dismantle white supremacy as a whole moving forward?
Well, that's another show, guys, because, you'd have to define what it means to you, because I don't feel like I am a white supremacist. And I don't think there's much white supremacy going on out there, but I need to have you define. See, this is one of the divides.
I'll tell you that to me, once again, this system is designed to work for the people that it was built by, and that's white folks, particularly old white men. And now that people have had enough, because those white folks I spoke about earlier who are out there, you know, who really love black people as much as they love black culture, and they're out there standing with black folks and they want to fight with us, I think this is the tipping point. And we right now are at a point where we can finally force America to live up to its grand promises of liberty and justice for all, and not just liberty and justice for white folks.
It has. That's my back to the beginning of the program.
Russ.
It has. It's out there. You guys have done it. Look, we're out of time here, but would you guys like to do this again where we pick it up right from this point and make a focus on white supremacy?
Not if we just going to dance the whole time. If you're going to have some honest conversation with us and stop telling us things like white privilege,
Charlemagne,
and you don't know what white supremacy is, if we could do that, yes.
Well, Rush, I'm very into having these conversations because I do think it is important for white people to acknowledge the hurt that they've inflicted on the African-American community and to be able to come forward and admit that we can't even move forward until that happens.
Yeah,
well, that's
what
I was attempting to do here with all of you today. On the white supremacy thing, I'm not in any kind of denial. I just know that it's a politically charged element of the Democrat Party's politics and liberalism, and I do not cave or compromise or give one iota of an inch to liberalism no matter what. So white supremacy or white privilege is a construct of today's Democrat Party, and I'm not going to agree with any aspect of it as they put it forth. I'm not denying that there are certain individuals out there who think they're better than other people, but structurally, institutionally, white supremacy, it's
Russ,
a construct.
You can't see how white people are just treated better in this country than black people?
Even just as far as
he
how many people
that.
Get pulled over by the
you
police
have
officers.
To see that. Like we can have these conversations, but we got to be honest with each other. Like, you got to admit that.
Disproportionately, black people are getting pulled over, disproportionately they're getting shot by the cops.
You set these things up. You have no idea how... I can imagine what you're going to say. If I sit here and say you have no idea how I have been mistreated by various elements, various groups, various companies, various individuals my whole life. It's called life,
Russ.
And it happens. And we're all mistreated. I've been fired 9 times in my career.
But have you ever got thrown out your car because you were driving a nice car?
Have you ever got patted down
just for being black?
Yeah, I've had my car keyed. I've had my tires blown up, of course.
I'm talking about throwing out your car by a police officer because you're black driving a nice car. Or walking down the street in Queens, the area where you're from, and the police pulling you over and patting you down. Has these things happened to you? Don't talk about keying a car. I done got shot at. They done shot up my car. Don't talk about keying a car and popping your tire. I'm talking about police officers pulling you out because you're black.
See, I'm a hermit. Because you did nothing. I'm a hermit and a recluse, and I don't go out and do all that kind of stuff. No, that kind of stuff has never happened to me. I'll grant you.
I want to ask you one more question before we get out of here.
I've never had the cops assume that I am. Well, actually, no, that isn't true. I have been pursued.
Oh, Russ, stop.
I have been pursued by the cops. I was pursued by. Absolutely, I have. But look, guys, let me thank you again for giving me the time today and having access to you and at least the chance to talk to you. I do appreciate it. And maybe we can do it again. I look forward to it.
Thank you, Russ.
Rest in peace, George Floyd. That's right. All those white kids out there on the front lines protesting and fighting with black people, I salute them. But why do you think they're out there, Russ?
Because they're fed up with what happened to George Floyd. They're fed up with this situation that will not stop, that caused all this and provided the opportunity for all this to happen, the opportunity to protest and riot. There are more Americans fed up with it than you know. That's my point.
What about America, though? You don't think that the fact that there's 40 million people who filed for unemployment? The largest unemployment rate since the Depression era. You don't think that they're fed up about that too?
Well, I already acknowledged that earlier in the conversation. You can't put 40 million people out of work, but I'm telling you that you have a lot of simpatico people out there. White people were marching in the 60s with Dr. King. There were, in fact, King's death did not cause this kind of strife in this country.
Martin Luther King Jr. is dead because of racism and white supremacy.
If that's your answer to everything, then I don't know where we go.
It is. He's dead because he was fighting against racism and white supremacy.
All right.
That's why he's dead.
Well, good luck, guys.
Thank you for the conversation.
If we can do this again, we'll do it again.
Now, this was a serious conversation. At times, an uncomfortable conversation. Even though we have vastly different viewpoints from Rush, it was an open conversation to have because the dialogue must be open beyond just our community if we are ever going to get a real change from all people. This is The Breakfast Club.
All right, today's podcast, or live stream rather, is titled Hip Hop Industries Plus Jeff Bezos Equal Billions of Dollars. I played that clip from The Breakfast Club because The Breakfast Club, their primary demographic is a hip hop demographic, but people like Rush Limbaugh, he's been on there, the late Rush Limbaugh, Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, presidents of, Mexico. President Joe Biden's been there. Vice President Kamala Harris has been on there. So there have been some high-profile guests on that show. But the Breakfast Club, although it caters to a hip-hop market, it's a niche within the hip-hop market. It's a significant one now. But it's black hip-hoppers. Now, black hip-hoppers, according to the stats here, make up 46% of the radio audience here in the United States. All right. Also here in the United States, you've got Latino or Hispanic hip-hoppers that make up 25% of the hip-hop demographic. Then biracial, white, and Asian, they lump them together. At 15% of the hip-hop demographic here in the United States. And that's ages 35 to 44. That's the age group. Now, you got a bunch of hip-hoppers, and Charlamagne and DJ Envy in particular, at least on The Breakfast Club. Now, this is just from my point of view. You might disagree with me. 619-768-2945. Press 1 if you disagree. Particularly Charlotte, actually both of them. They were coming from the, in my opinion, the black folks have the exclusive rights on victimhood here in the United States. It's like nobody else, nor the ethnic group, or majority group, or anybody within the majority group has ever been injured, discriminated against, shot, or killed by police. And this demographic, particularly the 46%, live in a very small, I mean, if you look at, you take the landscape of the United States, they live in a very, voluntarily, and almost like on, not even, you know what, smaller than reservations. Smaller than reservations, because you do have some Indian reservations in the United States that are actually bigger than one or two states in the United States. But maybe that's a different podcast. I'm going to play one more audio about the latest update in the Ahmaud Arbery case, and then we're going to get back into Hip Hop Ministries, Jeff, plus Bezos equal billions of dollars. I'm attempting to stack all this stuff up.
Charges of murder and now accusations of a cover-up. Tonight, a major development related to the murder case against three white men charged with killing a black man, Ahmaud Arbery, while he was jogging last year in Brunswick.
Well, today a grand jury indicted the now former prosecutor in Brunswick, accusing her of not fulfilling her duty to arrest and charge the three suspects right away. She has denied any wrongdoing. John Sherrick is on that story for us tonight.
It was the video that outraged a nation, showing Ahmaud Arbery, who is black, shot to death while jogging in Brunswick, leading to murder charges against three white men who are scheduled to go on trial next month. But investigators, including then-Brunswick DA Jackie Johnson, had that video months before it surfaced publicly. Why didn't she prosecute then? Now she's in trouble. A Glynn County grand jury just indicted Johnson for felony violation of oath of office. And also for a misdemeanor, she's accused of ordering police not to arrest the suspected trigger man, Travis McMichael, who is the son of Greg McMichael, a longtime employee of the DA's office.
It is not her job to tell them what to do or what not to do.
Atlanta attorney and 11 Alive legal analyst Paige Pate says the indictment also accuses Johnson of breaking the law in the way that she then got the case transferred to another DA, Waycross DA George Barnhill. Barnhill had already concluded that the suspects had acted in self-defense and he did not intend to prosecute them.
I think it was clear that she did want to keep the McMichaels from being charged, and that by directing it to a DA who she thought would basically share the same idea as she had about the case would keep them from getting charged.
Johnson emailed us last year, calling it all false accusations to make excuses and ignore the problems at the Glynn County Police Department. We were not able to reach her for comment on the indictment against her.
For more information on this case against Johnson and the men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery, just click on the story on 11alive.com.
Okay, we're going to come back to that in a moment. We're going to merge all this stuff together. Last week there was carried over this week, there was some power outages. We're going to link all this stuff up to Hip Hop Ministries plus Jeff Bezos equal billions of dollars in a moment.
This morning across the South, residents are reeling from Ida's devastation.
It's terrible, man. It's just so hard.
At least 17 deaths now blamed on the storm in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Louisiana's governor warning the death toll could rise.
Typically, it isn't the direct impact of the storm that kills the most people. It's post-storm activities.
While battling intense heat and humidity, hundreds of thousands in the region are still without power. Louisiana's largest electricity provider saying for some, power might not return until the end of September. Many are also facing food, water, and gas shortages.
We don't have any lights. We don't have any
you know, drinkable water. The hardest part is just trying to get in the stores and get food for my family.
And now 7 nursing homes in Louisiana are being shut down by the state after they evacuated residents into a single unfit warehouse ahead of the storm. Of some 800 relocated seniors, 7 have now died, and 5 of the deaths have been classified as storm-related fatalities.
They were on mattresses on floors, and they had a couple days of no air condition.
In Lafitte, where there are still feet of standing water, residents are shaken to the core.
It's all my neighbors. I love these people. These people are my family, and they're all suffering. They're all suffering. There's not a person on this body that's not suffering.
Painfully slow signs of progress in a long and challenging road to recovery.
I've done this over and over again. This is the worst I've ever seen.
Here in New Orleans, the blazing temperatures and lack of power have led the city to offer buses to shelters in northern Louisiana and neighboring states. Officials are hoping, though, that by Wednesday, power will be restored across the city. Tom?
We hope so. All right, Vaughn, thank you for that.
All right.
Hey, thanks for watching our YouTube channel. Find your favorite recipe, celebrity.
Man, stop that. Days, we're playing these clips. We're going to tie all this stuff. I'm going to attempt to tie it all together. Hip-hop Industries plus Jeff Bezos equal billions of dollars. Now, what does that have to do with people without electricity or power from Louisiana, I guess, all the way up to New Jersey or New York? We're going to attempt to tie all that in a moment, along with victimhood and this other stuff. The next clip we're playing deals with hip-hop billionaires.
I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. Jay-Z rapped that line back in 2005, 14 years before he would become hip-hop's first billionaire. The man behind Reasonable Doubt, The Blueprint, and The Black Album raked in $53.5 million this year, landing him at number 42 on our highest-earning celebrities list of 2020. Jay-Z was born Sean Corey Carter. He was the youngest of 4 and raised by his mother in the Marcy Projects in Brooklyn. His mother noticed his talent for music at an early age and gifted him a boombox to keep him out of trouble, as she put it. Music became his passion, but trouble eventually found him, and by his teens, Jay-Z began selling crack to survive. He never gave up on his dream of becoming an artist and began to use his experience on the streets to fuel his music. Jay-Z started his own label, Rockefeller Records, releasing his debut album, Reasonable Doubt, in 1996. Since then, Jay-Z has released 14 number one albums, won 22 Grammys, and appeared as a solo artist on Billboard's Hot 100 chart over 100 times. Jay-Z's empire is expansive, encompassing music, liquor, art, and real estate. And he doesn't just promote brands, he makes his own, securing equity deals instead of traditional endorsements. His music catalog hits close to 1 billion streams annually, valued at $75 million. His stake in Roc Nation, the wide-ranging entertainment company that represents everyone from Kevin Durant to Rihanna, is also valued at $75 million. He's strong on the beverage front. He owns 100% of Armand de Brignac with a stake valued at $310 million. And his joint venture with Bacardi selling Douce is valued at $100 million. He owns homes in East Hampton, Bel Air, and Tribeca, valued at $50 million net of debt, where he shares space with Beyonce Knowles and their 3 children, who are hopefully kept far away from his $70 million art collection.
Yellow Basquiat in my kitchen corner. Go ahead, lean on that blue, you own it,
In the works is another kind of blueprint, but this time, venture capital. In a nod to his childhood home, he launched Marcy Venture Partners, which raised an $85 million fund a year ago. And while many would be quite content living the billionaire lifestyle of Jay-Z, he's eager to make even more.
Oh, what a feeling. Oh, f*** it, I want a trillion.
For Jay-Z, everything and anything seems possible. Just give us enough time to count it all.
Okay. Okay, my board was sticking here a little bit. Today's podcast titled Hip Hop Industries, Jeff Bezos Plus Equal $1 billion. There's, you know, the clip that I start this podcast off every day, I haven't been able to find it because I wanted to play it to wrap everything else, wrap this stuff up. Reason why I played the last clip, because Jay-Z, who's a hip-hop billionaire, I think really should be the aspiration of anybody who thinks there is such a thing as white supremacy or all that type of stuff. Matter of fact, let me tie this into hip-hop. They're on the planet with, I don't think we're up to 8 billion people yet, but I know there's over 7 billion people on the planet. So 7 billion people plus on the planet, and the ones who are classified as billionaires, according to Forbes magazine, or at least the ones that are listed by Forbes magazine, because there are probably some that are not listed. But we'll use Forbes as the metric. They're less than 3,000. So on planet Earth, they're less than 3,000 people out of 7 billion who are billionaires. Now, in my research over the years of billionaires, the common denominator of billionaires, and I'm going to tie this all into the George Floyds, the black folk that get shot by the police, or anybody that got shot by the police, regardless of race or color. Victimhood and all that stuff. The common denominator that I've seen with billionaires is, for the most part, overwhelmingly, pioneers in their field, in their industry. Pioneers. They were in on something. They either created something or were in on something in the early stages. Pioneers. And typically in the pioneer phase, now this is very key important when it comes to wealth building and power. Matter of fact, in the movie Scarface, the character Scarface, you know, Tony Montana, one of his quotes that he said in there, and I agree with it, is first you get the money. Now that's why I play the Claude Anderson piece every morning. That's the first stage that Claude Anderson talks about for black folks in the United States. You have to start businesses and then morph those businesses into industries. That's the very first step that you've got to do. Tony Montana says you get the money first via the business that you start. And I recommend a family base business, because one of the issues with many families across the globe, regardless of country, regardless of color, race, religion, ethnicity, or all that, the primary issue with many families around the globe is typically the new generation has to start all over again from scratch. Meaning, they have to go get a job because there is no family-based business. If you have a family-based business, then you can hire your children or your grandchildren. That's the first thing. The second thing is they have to go find a place to stay. Those two things right there is around the globe, regardless of race, color, religion, or what have you. And this has absolutely nothing to do with white supremacy, because most white folks, they had to, in this country, had to start all over from scratch because there was no family business. The parents or the grandparents can't hire their children to be in the family business because there is no family business. And more than likely, they got to find their own place. And, you know, that stuff adds up. And you can't – the other steps that Claude Anderson talks about, you know, because after you start the business and you have the industries that morph from that, then you – because you're going to need money to buy political power. You're going to need money to get legislation on the books. You're going to need money to have an influence with the court system. You're going to need money to for instance, and let's go to Jake. As a matter of fact, you want, well, let's see. Let's name the hip-hop billionaires that I know of, at least. If you know of any others, let me know. 619-768-294. You got Jay-Z. He's one. He's a first-generation hip-hop billionaire. Now, hip-hop is just one industry. But the reason why him, Rihanna, she's a billionaire. Dr. Dre, billionaire. Hip-hop, at least at this time, and here's the common denominator with most billionaires, not all, but most. Number one, they're pioneers most of the time, not all of the time, but most of the time. Number two, pioneers, typically the common denominator is they get into something that has very little or no government regulation. You don't need a business license, and that's a low form of business regulation, to put out to write a song, to get it recorded, to get it played on air. There are no Fortune 500 companies trying to get into hip-hop. So the competition is like, you know, real low. And there are many things that, you know, hip-hop fashion. You know, Sean Combs, Puff Daddy, whatever his name is now. Okay. If he's not a billionaire, he's knocking at the door of it. He's also on the fashion fragrances. Once again, very little. I mean, you don't need think about it. None of the hip-hop billionaires have a bachelor's degree. There is no bachelor's degree program offered in starting a hip-hop business or some of these businesses that have made people become billionaires. Let's expand this outside the black realm of black billionaires. Bill Gates out of Harvard. Okay, no bachelor's degree. The late Steve Jobs. I don't even think he enrolled in school. He used to hang out like at Reed College or whatever out in California, but I don't think he was enrolled. Either way, if he was, he dropped out too. Mark Zuckerberg, billionaire, what, at 24, 25 years old, Facebook. Facebook, before it went public, he was a billionaire. Facebook is nothing, you know, whoever registered the name, Facebook.com, okay, I don't know if he registered the name with Yahoo for $2.50 to $5 or GoDaddy. I don't know who he registered the name to, but Facebook is nothing but a glorified website. He's got some regulation now due to the fact that he went public, but he was worth billions before Facebook went public. Okay. Now, this spring, this is why I disagree with Charlamagne. But you can disagree with me. This country, white supremacy has nothing to do with anything. This country is a capitalistic country. It's capital supremacy that runs the United States of America. It's as simple as, if you have the capital, if you have the cash, if you have the social capital, if you have the political capital, he who makes the gold makes the rules. It's really as simple as that. You had wealthy black people in colonial days. Paul Cuffey was one of them. He built ships. Paul Cuffey, look him up, black man in New England. He built ships, and he helped not only build the ship, but, you know, finance the first successful back-to-Africa trip that helped form the country that we know of today as not Liberia. That was the second one, but it's right on the tip of my tongue. It's not Senegal. Somebody look it up. Paul Cuffey, C-U-F-F-E-E. Oh, Sierra Leone. He helped found, he was involved with all of that. Black man in colonial times. All right. And there's a lot of stories like that. You know, like you said, in the United States right now, there are probably anywhere from 900 to 1,000 black townships in the United States. But typically all we hear about is Rosewood, which that's another podcast we've done before, and Black Wall Street, which was a 40-acre neighborhood. But it's capitalism. All right. So what I would recommend, this is something that everybody within the sound of my voice, now you might not want to become a billionaire or a millionaire, I get that, and not everybody, it's a small club, okay, that requires discipline. But what I do recommend is this, and this is why I played the New Orleans thing, because I was like sort of partially incapacitated last week. I'm in a different state than Louisiana, but I've got a couple of houses in Louisiana, which affected my cash flow for about a week. But I recommend this. And so far, the houses, I heard they were rocking. But overall, you know, just a little water damage on one. That's all I've heard so far. Hopefully, I won't hear any more worse than what I've the pictures they sent to me. But here's what I recommend for everybody, okay, is there's – hip hop, once again, is a huge, it's a broad spectrum. There's a lot of things you can do it. There's a lot of things within hip hop that have very low, business wise, that have very little or no government regulation. Then there's some things that are highly regulated. But hip hop, it's more than a community. It's a bunch of communities. It's a world in itself. But here's what I recommend, something simple that everybody can do. That might not be easy, but start a family. I mean, well, if you already got a family, start a family business. Start a family business. It could be baking pies, making socks, whatever widget that you want to think of. Start a family business, okay, and work on getting at least 100 clients. Now I'm saying at least. You want to build that up to a much larger number than 100, but have a goal, and then you can take that 100 clients, you know, 100 people that you sell pies to, 100 people that you might make clothes for, 100 people that you might drive to work or whatever. Get yourself whatever business that you're going to think of. And there's a lot of hip-hoppers out here because hip-hoppers spend money. They buy homes. They buy cars. They buy clothes. They buy everything. But get yourself a bare minimum 100 different clients. Bare minimum. Now, you might want to break that down. You're not going to get 100 off the bat. You know, let's do this. Do it the Steve Harvey way. You know, you got one. Get that first one, and then work your way up to 5, then work your way up to 10, and then, you know, 10, 20, 30, up until you get a solid 100 customers. Because if you got a solid 100 customers that pay you particularly a monthly income of some sort for whatever service that you might provide for them or what have you, then every month you're going to get anywhere from 75 to 80 paychecks per month. All right. Don't derail on that job. And some of you have a job, and then you might have a second job. Some of you got 3 jobs. I'm saying the way things are is not only now, but it's really always been this way, in my opinion, is get yourself a base of at least 100 customers. And we'll go more into detail on that on future podcasts, but look at the hip-hop industries, okay, because there's really very little competition in those, all right? And you don't have to be a rapper or anything like that. Hip-hop, you know, you can make money building houses for the hip-hop demographic. Well, because hip-hoppers buy everything. They're consumers. So regardless of whatever your age is, I would take a look at the hip-hop generation demographic and then their children, which is Generation Z. Generation Z are like people like 8 years old, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. Because now, like Laura Nelson, we've played her audio on here a few times. Laura Nelson is 12 years old right now, and she's built herself a little tiny house. So you got a bunch of people like that are doing that. So in any event, and I forgot to add Jeff Bezos on here. Let me add that on here with Jeff Bezos. And I defended Jeff Bezos 3 times. Some people don't like Jeff Bezos, whatever reason. I like to do. Because you have a lot of hip-hoppers. Well, you got people of all ages, but today we're talking about hip-hoppers. You have a lot of people on that are hip-hoppers that not only order from Amazon and eBay and sites like that, but you also have a lot of people that run a full-time business that support their families on Amazon. And Jeff Bezos, you know, created that whole thing. Now, person that I had to, and I got to stop getting to these cybermints on Facebook, on these comments. She called Jeff Bezos greedy. But here's how I looked at it. And Rob, I'm getting ready to open up your mic. There are over 28 to 30 million businesses in the United States with more people opening up, starting a business every day in their backyard, kitchen table, coffee table, carport, wherever. There are more businesses starting every day, but they're anywhere from 28 million to 30 million businesses in the United States right now. Amazon is just one. It's just one company out of over 28 million companies in the United States. So if anybody who works for anybody, Amazon, Sears, Ben's Chili Bowl, whatever place of business in the United States, they're there on a voluntary basis. If you don't like working for Ben's Chili Bowl, if you don't like working for Wendy's, if you don't like working for the Gap, Banana Republic, Marty's Rib Shack, Whole Foods, if you don't like working for any of those companies, you've got over 28 million companies in 50 states and the territories of the United States to go get a job that you do like. That's my comment on the people that don't like Jeff Bezos. Let's see. 425, your mic is open.
they might not like Jeff Bezos, but there are millions of people that have jobs, and even through the pandemic, because of Amazon, okay,
You're
and
correct.
Amazon delivery and Amazon Marketplace and all that. And then let's be clear on starting a family business, meaning you want to go get a tax ID or EIN number, and you want to register it with the state, not Amway or some multi-level marketing. Okay, let's be clear when we say start, begin a family business. Okay?
Right.
So, yeah, because you want to build or create. Go ahead.
Robin, well, you know, we and you were on the phone every day last week. You came, you ran a, I don't know how many times you did it last week. I know at least two times that I, you know, that I know about. But could you share with us now, because you live on in the Pacific Northwest, outside of Seattle, not Supersonics, Seattle, Washington. And you helped somebody, you don't have to mention names or nothing like that, with groceries in a city, well, let's say North Carolina. Somewhere in the Carolinas.
Right.
Now, run that down to us how you did that. Oh, and people listen to it closely because I like the business model that you used on this.
So, in a nutshell, a friend had a need, and that was for some groceries. They recently had a stroke, and family relatives just weren't available to help them out. So I said, send me a list, and then I went on the app on Walmart app, and loaded up. I didn't even have any money, but I had an EBT card, okay? So
okay.
I got loaded up on the app. And then, whoa, they wanted money for the delivery, but whoa, Walmart has a Walmart Plus now where you can get a trial, right? So 14
right.
days, you get that, and then free delivery. So I was able to order the groceries, put in their address, shop their local Walmart, and send them some groceries, bip, just like that. Same thing for when they had to get to a medical appointment. And their transportation bailed out on them. Rather, instead of missing the appointment, hold on a second, logged in to the app, Lyft, put in his address, put in the destination, and boom, send him a ride. So social capital, you can spend anywhere, instantly, in
now,
a minute, okay?
For people that are not regular listeners on here, give us the definition of social capital.
Okay, social capital is we look at money as currency. We're taught that money is currency. Okay, well, let me to the Word of God. The Word of God says, the blessings of the Lord maketh rich and addeth no sorrow. He says the blessings. He didn't say money makes you rich. So I'll give you an example. I just gave one. There was a need, and neither one of us had a dime in our pocket, but we were able to make like maybe $100 move with the transportation and with those groceries, right? So,
right.
So between the two of us, just out of dialogue, so it's energy, it's a frequency, and we basically vibed, right? So people, I'm trying to explain, are the currency, not money. You're the currency,
right? Yeah,
not the dollar.
They're the currency, and instead of government issued legal tender. Matter of fact,
yeah.
Since you brought up the Bible or something, if you look at the and a person that's listening to this, you can be a stone cold atheist right now, but listen to this. I think it's good examples of social capital. If you look at the miracles of Jesus, all that basically was based on social capital.
Mm-hmm.
There is no record when he turned water to when he's given credit when he's credited as turning water into wine. That was all social capital. There was no shekels or dinar or money exchanged in there.
Mm-hmm.
It was all social capital.
Mm-hmm.
He had his 12 disciples there, plus he had the servants there, his mother was there. All that was social capital. When he said, when he is credited in feeding 5,000, he didn't do that by himself. It was social capital. All right, he had, once again, he had to, look how many people involved. He had the 12 disciples. They helped because they had relationships with people within the crowd. Then somebody had within the 12 disciples had a relationship with the kid that had two fish and five loaves of bread. We don't know how long it took for that whole transaction to feed 5,000 people and then have 12 baskets of food left over, but all that was social capital. Everything he did was basically social capital. And I think what's happened today is a lot of people haven't been taught. They value the government-issued currencies, the dollars, the British pound, the euro, the peso. They value that more than people.
It's the dialogue. What did God do? He said, and God said. What did Jesus do? He gathered all 12 around of them, and then he spoke. He chatted with them. There was dialogue. So that's what's not happening now. Teaching, we're not talking about, hey, you know what? You're the money. You're the currency. We're just not having that dialogue because that's where it all happened. That's how it happened. Okay,
that
God
too.
Taught.
We need to have more
Jesus
dialogue
sat around
on,
and he taught and he told his disciples, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. We don't do that anymore. Where is that happening? You can't say, well, school, ha, ha, ha. Go to school and observe for yourself what's happening and walk out of there and tell me if it makes any sense to you. I can't do it anymore because if I go in and if I try to observe what my grandkids are doing at school, I know that they are being indoctrinated. I know I just see so many things that I'm ready to get a gun and just go blow everybody up, the school district, the blah, blah, you know, because, you know, you ain't messing up my baby, but that's not my child, so I can't do that.
Well,
but
we better keep you awake. Neighbor, you better homeschool him.
Man, I really wish that my daughter did. I was so happy when the pandemic kept the kids home.
Mm-hmm.
Because I fear, you know, when I see that them go away on that school bus, my grandkids, I pray, and I fear for what happens to them, you know. Because we send them to daycares, academia. We know the story about academia, but we send them away to these facilities, and then we trust people, doctors, church, school, and then they get molested, whatever. You know, there's just so many things that these children have to endure, and we send them out alone on a bus through 3.5. 4 years old. Jesus,
I'm a big proponent of homeschooling. Yeah, I'm a big proponent of homeschooling.
Mm-hmm.
I found that Claude Anderson piece because I wanted to tie it. It's how we start the program, then we'll go back to the phone lines.
there's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up, as I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Okay, those are the five steps according to Claude Anderson. Some people might disagree with him, but I use that as my basic metric. Listed now on the first step that he talks about, okay, start the business. Now, even before we get up to the industry part, which is all within step one, once again, I suggest start a family-based business. Start a family-based business. Okay. You baking pies, whatever you want to do, start a family-based business. Now, the second thing I recommend is get yourself, as you started, set goals to at least 100 customers. You know what? A higher goal than that is 1,000, but start off with 100, and then break that down. Get your first one, get your second one. That's two, and then work. You can do it by doubling every so often, or you got one, you got five, then get five more, then get five more. Get yourself 100 customers, and then once you got to 100, then do what you need to do to get it to 1,000 plus. All right, but 100 customers. If you're baking cupcakes, get you 100 people that like to buy cupcakes, particularly if they like to buy them on the regular. Okay, like every month, every week, whatever it is. You can work that part out. All right, now the the if you don't have one in your home already, home, car, possession, or what have you, go to your local Chinese restaurant and get yourself a menu. It can be any restaurant, but I'm just recommending Chinese because there's a lot of Chinese carryouts around. I probably got about 10 Chinese food restaurant menus in one of my cabinets here. Most of them are from the same place. Because every time they deliver, they give you a menu. Get yourself a Chinese food menu, restaurant menu, and I want you to count every item that they have for sale, from the egg foo young to the poo-poo platter, to the vegetarian dishes, to their specials, the cans of sodas, whatever they sell, count how many items they have in their product line, which is in their menu. All right. Now, typically, most of the Chinese food carryouts are family-based businesses. You might see a toddler running around, you know, mom and dad. Sometimes you'll see the grandparents. Okay. We're talking about generations here. But count, and the reason why I'm asking you to count how many items are on that menu, because that represents revenue centers. They're not, put it this way. Let's take your job. You work at IBM or someplace like that. It doesn't matter. Okay. You got a 9-to-5. That's your job. And that represents one revenue source. So you might be working at IBM, but, you know, things are kind of tight. You need a second job. Well, now let's compare your income sources with the Chinese food revenue sources. So you got an IBM job that where you get a paycheck every 2 weeks. One of the items on their menu are egg rolls. And they get paid every day because somebody's ordering egg rolls off that menu. All right. Things are kind of tight with, and you can't leave that job to IBM. You're not going to leave that to the next generation. That don't happen. But with the Chinese food restaurant, they can do that. And they're training the next generation right on the job. And then the older people had a retirement coming from the job. I mean, from the business, family business. So you get a second job. Well, let's go to the Chinese food menu. Let's say they sell sodas. Okay, so, and they sell maybe 3 or 4 different types of sodas. So they sell sodas every day, another source of income, while you are going out looking for a second job. Let's say you got those two jobs. You need a third job. There's only 24 hours in a day. Okay. Well, they might, well, they not might. That's why I'm telling you what you want to do with your business. And it's going to be different for everybody. This is a very simplified explanation I'm putting out here. Is count the number, their product line on a Chinese. You want to, if you can, depending on what type of business that you have, try to replicate that in your family-based business. You're not going to have it on day one. We get that. On day one, you just might be trying to think of a name. As Robin said, you get your EIN number. But, get the first item. And, just more from there. It's going to be different for everybody. Okay. But the thing is, try to have as a goal, one goal is to get yourself 100 clients, okay, that represents 100 paychecks coming, potentially 100 paychecks, because we want to use the 80-20 rule. 80% will pay you every month, 20% for whatever, life happens, they can't pay you. But you'll still be able to roll on because you got the 75 to 80% that are paying. You won't miss a beat. All right. And then the so you got those clients, and then you got a product line where, you know, you got whatever. Attorneys who menu on just on site probably has at least 100 items on it, if not more. It all depends on a particular restaurant. But, or if you don't like Chinese food, just look at any menu. You know what? Even McDonald's. Okay, McDonald's is, we know that the hamburgers represent cash flow. That's one revenue center. The cheeseburgers represent another revenue center. The Big Mac, you know, represents another revenue center. The quarter pounder represents another revenue center. You want to have a product line just like a McDonald's or a Chinese food restaurant or Greek or take your pick. Robin, any other comments before we go to the next caller?
Oh, no.
Okay. Oh, by the way, you know what? What's going on with Vibes Live? How can people tap into that?
Oh, you can tune in at vibeslive.com. VIBES-LIVE.com. Yeah, so
okay.
I've been running on the Hilltop, been co-hosting on the Hilltop radio show weeknight.
Now, Robin, we can have them, man, anytime this week. Just let me know.
Okay, I surely will. Let them know. You can find me there weeknights at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific. The Hilltop radio show on Blog Talk Radio.
Now, what's that show about, Hilltop?
Oh, my goodness. It is the hottest hip-hop talk show on the planet worldwide. And we interview independent artists, mainstream artists. We have a awesome panel with DJ Sean, Bonita Applebaum, myself, Robin Lynn Maben, and more. Yeah, DJ Devo, DJ DQ. Yes.
I gotta talk
to
you sometime. I got a hip hop. I call him a hip hop reverend. I was just talking to him last week. We can get him on that show. All right. Well, I'll be listening tonight. All right. That's 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Okay.
Right here on Blog Talk Radio. The Hilltop Radio Show, and the phone number 516-453-9110. Tell them Robin Lynn sent you. 516-453-9110.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that. We'll be tuning in tonight. 314 area code, your mic is open.
Ellie.
Yes, sir.
You have covered topics from A to Z, and you got 3 minutes before the show ends, and you want people to come
well,
in.
Well, it's going overtime as it usually does.
Yeah. And, you know, I appreciate what you do, but if I can give you some advice, I think you have too many topics out there, and people can't comment on them. Those effectively.
Well, you know, make a very good point. Well, you're right. Some days, which are probably about half the days I do this, I need to keep it real simple. Put one topic out there, and that's it.
Well, yeah, you should. Let me say this. You start off in the morning with your motivation. You start at 9:30.
Mm-hmm.
10 o'clock, you stop that. You start playing skits. Then at 11 o'clock, you start adding your own comment Well, the first skit that you, the comments, I think the earliest comment that you had today, and I started taking those, was Rush Limbaugh. And then you went on.
And you know what? That really should have been enough right there.
That should have been enough right there.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Absolutely.
Then
right.
Let me tell you something else too. You commonly tell people about the 100 based off of what Steve Harvey said,
mm-hmm.
that they need to do one thing 100 times. You have mentioned that 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times. If I can give you some little advice on these particular topics, get
mm-hmm.
somebody who's doing those businesses to come in and tell you the ins and outs and what it took for them to get their business going. Whether it's successful or a failure. Because
excellent
you just
idea.
Can't cover all those things. And I was going to ask Robin this. How is it that you don't even have a dime in your pocket in 2021? And I'm not being slick, not being insulted.
Oh, no, that was just at that particular moment.
Yeah, that don't make any – I mean, it's hard for people to conceptualize. You don't have a dime in your pocket? Oh,
that was just at that particular moment in that situation. You know, we were in the dialogue.
She qualified
you
that.
Know.
Social capital, if you have social capital, why do you need to dime?
Well, you know, let me tell you something. And going by what you described, the one key thing that you described with this particular person is that their family is in dire consequences or dysfunctional. And that's the
yep.
effects of what she or whoever this person was. Where is the family? So you can see at the moment, you cannot correct at the moment the way it is because of what others way before that did not do that they should be doing. It's impossible.
Well, you're right. That alone is a whole podcast. It's not a whole podcast series.
And you know the way news
but,
is reported.
You know what? But where is it? I mean, there's always this. Well, I can't say always. There's a lot of dysfunction out here. I mean,
Black
Adam
talk
and Eve
about
is a
too
dysfunctional
much dysfunction.
Family.
This is me, my opinion. I hear too much news reporting on black dysfunction. I don't give a damn what it is. I was reading an article here just a minute ago. It's talking about working from home while blacks.
Okay.
And it goes on to say, blacks employees regularly grapple with how to counteract negative racial stereotypes that undermine their professional images in the office. Well, okay, that's cool. Then it goes on to say that working at home also identifies their personal living spaces. So what can managing coworkers do to enact inclusive practices in support of black workers, particularly as working from home? Now, what in the hell do a manager of an office have to do with a person's home, a black person's home? What do you expect them to do? I mean, think about it. What do you want to do, send a Kelly girl over to clean the house up? So
if
blacks have, wait a minute, hang on for a second.
No
just
more office managers.
Listen at this. Listen at this. If they're having all these racial problems at the office, now they're at home. And now you're identifying problems they're having in their own damn house. What the hell?
Anybody out there that might be working from home? Give us a call right
some
now,
of these folks just write stuff just to be right. And let me tell you something else. On that report about the storm in Louisiana, I went
yes,
through
sir.
That storm last week.
What part of Louisiana were you in?
I'm outside of Baton Rouge. But it
okay.
was a heck of a windstorm that reached where I was. We didn't get water.
Right.
But it was a windstorm.
Okay.
It blew down stuff.
Uh-huh.
Even listening to that report... Listening to that report, they're making it sound like the storm is beating up on black folks. Well, damn. if blacks are the majority in New Orleans, 80-some-odd percent, 88%, and New Orleans sits below the sea level, in some places you can be in your front yard, look toward the ocean, and you can see ships above you down there. You look it up. Well, what
do
you
expect is going to happen? Sea level. Yeah.
L.A., what do these people expect is going to happen? It ain't that the storm is beating up on black folks. Take all the blacks out of there and put chihuahuas in there. It would beat up on them. Put penguins in there. It would beat up on them. That's just the way it works.
Me personally, I wouldn't want to live in New Orleans on a regular basis, but
well, sooner or later,
because it is below
the
sea level.
Sooner or later, should you not get the hint? You know, you were talking about Charmaine and Rush Limbaugh. I think Rush Limbaugh asked the question. But these people, and see, here's another thing. You make an emphasis about building houses for hip-hoppers. Well, how many hip-hoppers got enough money to build a house? You only talking about a handful of people. I build buildings. So give me five hip-hoppers I can build a building for. You can't build, you know what?
Bianca, you build bridges and high-rise buildings, man.
I can build a house. I build
house. Yeah, I know. There's nothing typical you build. You build big.
I built it and I abandoned it because of the damn fools in the damn in that area. But go ahead. You're saying that it's good to build houses.
You know what? You
say it's good to build a house for hip hoppers. That's not possible. That ain't enough. If it's 1,000, if it's 500 hip hoppers, that's you build 500 home. What you gonna do next?
Well,
and how
I
many
think,
is gonna do
right,
that?
Your grandson, who your grandson's been on here at least once. What I don't know what generation he would be included in, but. If he does follow what you're talking about, but if you had, or I'm just say for the sake of conversation, your grandson is a hip hopper. I talked to him once, very much on the ball guy. You got him in the right direction. You're big on STEM, okay? Because you do have hip hoppers that are in the STEM programs in the college. But a lot of people don't talk about that. Those people, though.
Well, those are the ones that should be talked about. My grandson is not no hip hop. My grandson is a baseball freak, and also
I was talking about age.
But
here's
the thing.
Yeah.
Oh, age. Well, he was
born
in 1997.
That's all I'm talking about.
Yeah,
I know he's not that.
97.
Right.
97. He was born in 2000. But anyway, the thing that I'm saying is that these excuses, like you heard with him. Is about what I want to know. What is white?
Well, you know, you're talking about what Charlemagne was making excuses. In my opinion, Charlemagne was making excuses.
I started writing notes, and I started at the top of the note. The last thing that I got down before I stopped taking notes, a long list of notes. You know how many I create a lot of notes when I listen to your shows, and it's just too many.
You
but
know,
on
to
this thing
start
that they
tomorrow,
was talking about,
what we're gonna do is we're gonna cut out the Claude Anderson thing. We'll cut the motivation stuff.
Yeah, because ain't nobody heard. How many people have heard about Claude Anderson? I ain't never heard of Claude Anderson when I got started my business. I don't even know who the heck he is. And listening to what he say, I couldn't follow that. But anyway, getting back, what the heck is white supremacy these people speak talking about?
Well, that, you know, that's
what
a good
laws
word.
Go against, what laws
I,
go against blacks?
All right, for me personally, I think it's in somebody's head. I don't see it as a real thing. Now, that's just me speaking. I don't think it's a real it's a myth. That's the way I look at it.
Well, apparently it must be something other than just a slogan, but I think it's a slogan because no one can point this stuff out. What laws go against black people? How in the heck, what body of government sits down and say, we are going to ordain in a municipality, we are going to legislate at a state level laws that only apply to blacks? Please, I beg you, please, If I get on my knee, tell me, which one?
I think the problem is the absence of black participation. For instance, and I've said this several times on this podcast, another podcast as well. You know, we're the black political action organizations, the black PACs that, you know, bankroll legislation. You know, there's probably some out there I don't know about, but there's not enough. We need more black business. And when I say black business, I don't mean one person and you're laying drywall by yourself. You ought to come up. I'm talking about a real business like you've run where you have employees and, you know, you're cutting payroll checks. We don't have a whole lot of those. We need more of that.
I had employees, when they retire, their retirement from one source is about $80,000 a year. From one source. House paid for, plus they retire with lease a lease about $500,000 sitting there in an annuity. So that's what's available out there.
That's true.
White supremacy, laws that go against black.
Oh, and there's a whole lot of poor white folks.
Absolutely, but we're only talking about blacks. What laws go against blacks? I want to know what that is, too. I'm being serious about this. Now, I can tell you what laws go against me. This proposal by Sheila Jackson Lee, the Firearm License and Registration Act, concerns in the area she represents in Texas. Well, then I asked this question. Then why don't you just concern yourself with that area in your own district in Texas? Why are you trying to impose a national, at the federal level, firearms regulations? Because I don't have those problems that you're having in your district in Texas that want you to take guns away from everybody. Please.
Well, you know,
why do I have to
just
go?
Like we're in Wild
license of firearms and ammunition
Minnesota.
Possession. They want the DOJ to license firearms, ammunition, and the registrations of, I don't need that. Then it gets bad, worse, sir. You got in another city, I think that's Missouri, you got a law that want to create extreme risk orders of protection. That is, if you are talking about hurting yourself, then you need to be brought in before a judge and let them evaluate you. Well, if that's the person, yes, but leave me alone. I ain't doing that. You got another law out of Illinois where they want to serialize all ammunition. How the hell are you going to put a serial number on every damn bullet that's out there made? Think about that.
That is crazy.
So it's laws like that people sit around and think of instead of them being applied for your immediate problem and area, they want everybody to come under their jurisdiction. And I think it is totally, totally ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. Too much government regulation.
And another thing that Rush asked him, why you keep voting Democrat?
They didn't answer that question.
In St. Louis area, blacks been voting Democrat for 72 damn years. 72 years. Some of these are household names. So here's the thing. If you got all these problems today in 2021, and you can look back in the history and observe the continuum in politics that you practice, and then you want to go to government about complaining about the situation you're in, well, why you continue to vote for the same government leadership, the same particular party? Even though if you come in and Robin, I'm going to give you the, if you wanted to be an elected official in St. Louis City, you got to be a Democrat. You can't go in there wanting to be a Republican or anything else. And if you're going to be a Democrat, you're going to have to follow their prescribed behavior that they want you to do. Follow their rules, their platforms. Yeah. You can't do it any other way. You know why? Because they won't give you no money. They won't give you the airtime on radio programs. Hank Thomas radio program. Bernie Hayes radio program. In Chicago, they got that 9:10 a.m. Listen to that program. All day long, it's about what white folks doing. Detroit is another one. Detroit got 600 and some odd thousand blacks in the city of Detroit. They make up about 78% or maybe 88% of the damn city. And they still complaining. 600 some odd thousand blacks in Detroit make up 88% of the population. And they complaining about the politics. Well, hell, you elect the politics.
Yeah, they sure. Well, Coleman Young was mayor for, 20 years straight. Dave Bing was mayor for at least one term. I don't know if he did more than one term. They got a black female attorney. Well, I don't know if she still is a DA in Wayne County.
Got a mayor, Dubin. He's white. He's ran.
He's been elected
two terms.
But look how many black mayors they had before him, though.
Well, yeah, but hang on for a second. He's been elected Dubin. And you got blacks outside is calling blacks in Detroit fools for voting for a white mayor. Now, you got two different persuasion of thoughts there. Those in Detroit, you got those on the outside that's complaining that blacks are fools for voting a white mayor. All right, those two different views of thought. You got another woman that's a Tlaib. She took part of or all of John Conyers' congressional seat. Everything comes out of her mouth is about Palestine. She was voted in by black folk. All right, that's three different views of thought. I thought all black folks was the same. It don't look like that to me. Police are employees of municipalities who approve of their toughness. I'm going back to Charmaine. They keep talking about what the police, like they said, that if you're in a nice car and the police are going to stop you and pull you out. I had police do me like that. You know what they were doing? I was driving a BMW motorcycle. Police stopped me. Two different police stopped me twice. You know what they wanted? They said, I ain't never seen one of these. I want to see it. So what? Mm-hmm. They didn't beat me up. So this don't apply to everybody. There's no national police department that runs under any particular set of rules and regulations. And the way they sound on that show is if there is. The way they sound on that show talking to all those young hip-hoppers, they come out away from that program thinking, yeah, it's one police department that the president controls, and Joe Biden is going to do something. That ain't the way it works. I know some black municipalities that if ULA is driving around looking lost, guess what them black cops are going to do? They're going to pull you over and ask you, may I help you?
Yeah, that's true.
They talking about black unemployment was going down under Donald Trump. Guess what? It plunged under Trump. You see how they say things? Well, it was going down under Donald Trump.
Well,
yeah, but the person that they're talking to should respond and say it plunged, it nosedived under Donald Trump. And it did. Look at the charts.
Right. On a Breakfast Club, a lot of their reporting is if you want to call it reporting, comes from a victimhood mindset.
Well, absolutely. And then, too, and I want to say this one thing, and I just got you looking at this, at the educational attainment. Blacks are doing much, much better as far as educational attainment, which I'm happy to see. They are obtaining more advanced
degrees. Yeah, we got more college degrees. And
they are obtaining more advanced degrees.
Well.
Now, the question is this, in what area are they obtaining these degrees in? Because still, blacks in the health fields, their presence is over 20-some-odd percent. I think it's maybe like 24%, 22%, and they make up only 13% of the population. Of the workforce is what the numbers, the percentage they should be looking at, not the percentage of black people in the population of the United States. What percentage of those that's able to work, where are they working at? What areas of education are they in? That's what should be looked at. Because those under 18 years old, you don't expect much out of them. And once you get up to about 50 years, 55, you ain't going to expect much out of them. It's those in between. And starting out in an educational attainment field, you look at those from 18 on up to about 32 or 35. What fields are they going into? And you see overwhelmingly, like it has been reported, black college students are overrepresented. When they say overrepresented, they look at your percentages in the population. Overrepresented in what? Low-paying majors. All right. We know
now, what are some then of the low-paying majors? You know, off the top of your head. I mean,
social
other than liberal
work.
Arts.
Social work professions.
Okay.
Childhood development.
Sociology. Okay.
Childhood development. Businesses like the, in some businesses, and you know,
a lot of colleges offer the general BA or bachelor's program of what, business administration.
Business administration is another low paying profession.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you see a lot of them at, in those social and health, your home health care, CNA, Certified Nurses Assistant. Is that right? Am I right on that,
yeah,
Robin?
They got schools set up for those now where you can just go in a matter of months, get a certificate and start working in that. You don't need a four-year degree for those now.
Yeah. Now, you're going to ask yourself, well, why are they going into these low-paying majors? Well, that opens up another discussion. You got to look at what they was influenced by before they got to the college door. And then there lies another problem. There lies another problem that's highly affected by the politics. And that's your schooling, your public education. It's highly affected by the dysfunction that goes on in the family structure. Single adult-headed families, oftentimes more than not females. All those things play a part. When you look at a car that drives out of a factory, the test driver is in it, they turn the light, windshield wipers, blow the horn and all that stuff, drive and stop. Well, go back to the beginning when it started off just as a frame, and as they began to put components and parts onto that frame. That's the same thing you're looking at with this low-paying majors. The low-paying majors, when they come out the factory, what causes it goes all the way back to the frame and the things that's applied to the frame. Go
good
all the
analogy.
Way back to preschool on what's
good
going
analogy.
On with these children.
Right. Very good analogy.
And, you know, I'm going to be funny with this. By the time a child, black child, I ain't saying all, but a lot of them. Hell, by the time they get ready to come out of high school, they all graduated burned out. They have a big graduation, tuxie and buying limousine rental when they come out of preschool. Another one when they come out of kindergarten. Another graduation like that ceremony when they come out of middle school going into high school. Well, hell, by the time they get to high school and get ready, they burned out. Surely the suit don't fit.
That's true.
Mm.
Dr. Boyce Watkins made a comment on that when it comes to business in general. He was saying that black folk, by the time we start, you know, let's say we graduate from, you know, undergrad, four-year degree with that, and then, let's say, enroll into an MBA program, Master's of Business Administration. He says that, and that was, that's what, 22, 23, 24, those ages? He says that's too late. He gave an example of, like, an Asian or foreign person that comes to this country, and that you take the kid that's walking around a Chinese food restaurant right now or the Mini Mart or the Gas Mart or whatever you call those marts where people get gas and Fritos or whatever. They're bought up. In, like, for instance, with the George Floyd thing, that place where the whole incident jumped off at, that was a convenience mark, a convenience store. The guy who runs that was third generation. You know what, the Patel family that you know about.
You know how they use it, L.A.? They use it to generate capital to send home to build up whatever it is that their family trying to do.
Right.
And they continue. The lady that does my taxes, an Indian, she has two daughters in medical school. Two daughters in med school.
That's super expensive.
That's what she used the money for. Look at you talk about Haiti. At one
but look
point
at the
time,
return that she's going to get on that money, though. Two doctors in the family.
Look at Haiti. Haitians in this country was the highest immigrant group that send remittances back home at one point. I don't know who it is now. Maybe Mexican. They sent billions back home. I think it was, I tell you what, Nigerians are scheduled to eclipse about $25 billion being sent back home. All right? Let's look at something else here. You talk about
and none of them talk
the
about
mid-age.
White supremacy.
No, they don't. You talk about people that's in your neighborhood, in these black hoods area with the stores like the one that you pointed out with George Floyd. Okay. They send their money home. They don't invest in their community. So where's the complaint? We talk about blacks need to circulate their dollars in their
community.
You know
what? We need to do a podcast. I'm going to do some numbers on it. I hope we'll do it, if not tomorrow, by Friday. Because you're right. Instead of going to the club or whatever, they're sending that money back home.
They send the money back home and do what they have to do. In some cases, the money end up buying weapons that's used against American soldiers. But in Haiti, if they send billions back to Haiti, then why come Haiti is like it is today?
Good. You know, now, I ran into a family some years ago up in Buffalo, New York. They were a Jamaican family, and they were buying up buildings because at that time in Buffalo, you can buy buildings for like $1,000 or even less. But they would fly up other Jamaicans up to Buffalo, New York, and they had a little cottage industry going. All they were doing was fixing up buildings, renting them out, and selling them. But
the Chinese started their own Greyhound. Remember?
Yeah,
the Chinese started their own Greyhound.
Yeah, they sure did. Yeah, Chinese bus.
So you are absolutely right. There's so many opportunities here in the United States for those that want to get involved. Now, me, myself, see, here's another thing. Once people get set, quote, unquote, they ain't going out there fooling with those things, those opportunities. We talk about them and tell you what we see, but we're not getting involved in that because you got chances. You have risks.
Right.
And the riskier an adventure is, the more it's going to pay. But that's stuff for young people to do. Older people are not going to be doing those risky things because they don't have much life to recover.
Bianca, let me ask you this because you know you do this on a regular. Your take on young people learning about stocks.
Well, they can learn about stocks, but it's not for everybody.
Okay.
It's not for everybody. And it's about you can do it from a speculative point of view, and you can do it from an investment point of view. It's not doing it. You do it as from an investment point of view, even if you don't know it. Now you got to pay into 401ks. That's an investment point of view. When you out there trading in some of the areas of day trading, swing trading, option trade, those are risks. A risk that you shouldn't involve yourself in unless you could go step out the front door and throw that same money up in the air and go back in the house and don't care about it. Now, some people master those risks, like you've heard us talk about. And see, here's the thing. You always going to be playing on somebody's weakness. somebody's weakness. That's the way it is. Some gonna win, some gonna lose. I know what your habits are. I'm gonna position myself to take advantage of your weak habits. And your weak habits is from somebody teaching you the general perspective on how to play the game. If you want to play like that, somebody else who on a more higher, advanced perspective is going to wear you out every time. You talk to buy low and hold and sell high. I like that because I'm going to take advantage of that weakness that you have. Buy and holding, I'm going to take it. Anyway, so much.
Good point. All right. Well, thank you, Pianchi. Thank you, Robin. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Robin, I hope
and
you get more
we'll
of a dime in your
I don't know what we're going to be talking about tomorrow.
I do. I'm all right. I'm fine.
All right.
Thank you for checking on me.
Okay. On that note, well, if you guys want to talk about anything in particular tomorrow, let me know. Just contact me and that'll be the topic for tomorrow. Because half the time, I don't know what I'm going to talk about until 30 minutes or even 15 minutes until we do it. So, but we're going to try to simplify it as Pianchi suggested. It, you know, put a simple topic out there and then go from there. Anyway, our main focus anyway is really community-based businesses, which we're working on that on a daily. So I got a Patreon page that will be launched this week. That'll be under It's My House TV. And then we'll post it on our Facebook page, which is also It's My House TV, and of course, the name of this podcast. Our whole brand on all social media is It's My House TV. So the Patreon page will feature talks and chats and information where we're actually doing stuff offline that we won't mention here on the blog talk thing. The blog talk thing is, we do networking here and that type of stuff, but the Patreon, that'll be going more into detail. So on that note, we're way over time. It's 1 o'clock. Thanks for listening, everyone, and have a good rest of the day.